Hello, everyone. I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from The Oldie. This month sees The Oldie podcast venture out from under its lockdown rock in Dorset to London and the refined elegance of Wilton's restaurant on Jermyn Street in St James's. Just a spot for a cup of tea with my guest, the actress Madeline Smith, who writes candidly in this month's edition of the magazine about memories of working with that genius of stage and screen, the late Sir Alec Guinness, who many remember as Colonel Nicholson in David Lean's Bridge Over the River Kwai, or for his portrayal of John le Carré's George Smiley in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and latterly as Obi-Wan Kenobi in George Lucas's Star Wars trilogy. We began in bed with Sir Roger Moore. I hope you enjoy the programme.
So we start anyway in Pinewood in 1973. And there you are in January. So
freezing, it's cold. Freezing cold.
But you're snuggled up in bed with Roger Moore.
We may have been rolling around in bed together. I'm not quite sure the moment where he said it. But he said, never mind about this little film.
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Your proper job, and that was his actual word, your proper job is with Alec, or Sir Alec, as he already was, when you do this, when you take part in Alan Bennett's play Habeas Corpus. He was absolutely thrilled to bits for me.
When you got the news about Habeas Corpus, what was your reaction?
It was a slightly slow reaction, Harry, because I had in fact auditioned for it, and it came about because I had already met management, the management, Michael Codron's management. Mm. Michael Codron was then almost king of the West End.
A great theatre producer.
Wonderful man too, beautiful guy, and still very much alive. And I had auditioned for, I believe it was Girl in My Soup, as a takeover. I was actually filming for The Two Ronnies. I was invited to audition for the part of Felicity in this brand new play.
Felicity Rumpers.
Yes, Felicity Rumpers. And I went to the Portobello Road to meet the wonderful, highly eccentric Ronald Eyre. Now, you'll know him.
Of course, he's a great.
Do you remember the Christianity? Do you remember all that?
Yep.
The series on telly?
Very much, yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. That was subsequent. That was later. He was always questioning, Ron. Marvellous man. Very shy, very diffident, always head down. Anyway, I clambered up the stairs of his little flat above a shop, I think, in Portobello Road. And he looked at me and he said, I'm not quite sure why you're here. And I was very taken aback. Why have I got to see you? I said, well, I believe I've come to audition for a part. I think it was still as yet unnamed, being a new play. A part in a new play. Oh, yes. Anyway, we talked about everything under the sun, and I then trotted down the stairs and thought, what was that all about?
He had a very formative role in creating the script, because
He
largely pruned it down, didn't he?
He pruned and pruned and pruned and pruned it from, I believe, hearsay has it, that it was about 5 hours, because Alan writes reams expecting it to be pruned. So anyway, I then hear that I've got the part in this new play.
Habeas Corpus was very similar to sort of Ray Cooney farces in that sense.
No trousers came off, though.
Well, of course, obviously not.
No. The key figure in Habeas Corpus, of course, was the Doctor.
Dr. Wicksteed.
Wicksteed.
Yeah. Alec Guinness, of course. What are your reminiscences of the first time you met?
Very quiet. Very shy. Not unlike Ron, actually. The two of them were always knuckled down in a corner, going through the script. We say that Ron was responsible for pruning, but so was Alec. Alec had a huge part.
He took the same line in Star Wars too, when he was Obi-Wan Kenobi. He played a lot with the script there too, didn't he?
He did indeed. Mm. And may I tell you that he nearly walked from Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy in exactly the same way that he nearly walked from Habeas Corpus. When we were on tour in Oxford, a very short tour, it was just Oxford, it's not really a tour, when we were banked down in Oxford, he was very miserable. He didn't quite know what to make of the play, He thought mistakenly that the audience didn't know what to make of the play. They were not coming in droves, and I don't think there was much feedback. And it was well known that he very nearly walked out.
He always comes across to me as a very...
Very shy, particular. very worried man.
Very detailed in his approach to everything.
Terribly detailed. And you know something, Harry? He reminds me hugely, now we're talking, of Peter Cushing.
Really?
So,
who, of course, you work
unbelievably
with
alike.
In your first
major break.
As soon
as you said detailed, both Alec and Peter Cushing, I think, when I think of them, when you ask me to remember, I think of them huddled in corners, bent over a piece of paper.
Peter Cushing, of course, the master of Hammer House of Horror Films.
Wonderful. And a terrible worrier. Terrible worrier. Both he and Alec Guinness, exquisitely dressed. And, of course, in the days when I was doing plays, people, and indeed in films, people would turn up for filming, or people would turn up for even the technicians in filming, and people would turn up to rehearse plays exquisitely dressed. I mean, now people would come in a filthy T-shirt and some rumpled trousers and probably the gardening outfit, literally, and I'm not exaggerating. In those days, so Alec would turn up in a suit. Ron Eyre always turned up in a suit. I remember Patrick Garland subsequently in another play turning up always in a suit, a beautiful jumper. I remember we talk of Peter Cushing, that I've now seen behind-the-scenes stills which have reminded me that when I did a film with Peter Cushing, Roy Ward Baker directing, everybody, the cameraman, the camera operator, the lighting man, the grip, they all wore shirts and ties.
You talk about the air being not
and
exact.
And so my first impression then of Alec is of a very shy, very diffident man with a bit of a paunch, bless him.
You said
loved his grub, and always used to eat in the best, finest restaurants, even before a matinee. He'd be off, have it somewhere good.
But you said that in Habeas Corpus, he rather strangely, perhaps, or as a character, he wore a wig and he also wore a corset.
Exactly the same as Peter Cushing, who never, ever appeared as himself. Always, always a beautiful wig. Nobody would have detected that Alec had a wig or a corset. Nobody. But also, I think, again, both men, and I'm going to stop this comparison now, but it's quite fundamental. Alec will have gone through this script privately over many meals, a lot of Stilton cheese, with Ron and with Alan long before we ever rehearsed. And so, in a way, he will have come totally prepared. He certainly knew all his lines.
Alan, you say, lay on
many
top
of the lines top. That were discarded, may I add.
But he lay on top of the... eating biscuits and
no,
just
darling,
happy.
Not biscuits. Biscuits. Fortnum's cakes. He lay on top of the piano, box of cakes on his tummy, and, of course, people came and helped themselves. But he was not averse himself, dear Alan, and he used to go to sleep. He'd clamber up and lie down on the piano, and he used to go to sleep. And of course, his little leg is dangling off. He's not a small man. And then, of course, constantly called upon by Ron, you see, that, sorry, all this going on. What was particularly unnerving for me, Harry, was that I used to sit on these incredibly uncomfortable chairs in the crypt of St. James's while we rehearsed, and day after day would go by, and I hadn't rehearsed my part. Because of all the pruning, because of Alec's detailed work, the fact that he was it, he was the play, and little Felicity, who was going to drift, myself, who was going to drift in and out in her pink frock and beads, was of very little significance to Ron Eyre. And it wasn't until we were in Oxford, may I add, that I was rehearsed.
But you...
Just before opening night, Ron said, well, we'd better get round to you then. So we went to the top of the theatre, and in a rather bleak room, and Ron said, OK, well, this is fine. I said, oh, yes, that's absolutely fine, whatever. Well, you come in here and you come in there. Well, you've been watching it long enough, you'll be fine.
But
on the first night, Harry, because I wasn't fine, I glugged a very large glass of red wine before going on, and I whispered to Alec, I've just had a a very large glass of red wine. And he said, "You are a very stupid girl to do that." And when I got onto the stage and stood there, and it's absolutely, it was relayed to me subsequently by my father, who was in the audience, my knees locked. They absolutely locked. And I wasn't sure I'd be able to move. And that was the result of the red wine, I'm afraid. And see, I've never, ever done that since.
It didn't give you the Dutch courage you hoped for.
It did not.
No.
I do not recommend it to anybody.
What was your...
Yes.
What was your... I mean, apart from Alec Guinness's professionalism, and he was, you know, one of the great actors of all time.
He certainly was. I cannot tell you how brilliant he was. And we talk of detailed. It was he that invented his dance of death at the end. But I mean, he was riddled and full of ideas.
What did you learn from him specifically?
Timing. I'd already learnt comedy timing from Arthur Lowe, watching him and working with him. He's my other hero. From Alec, I learnt about peace, total peace, and having an inner life and not wasting energy before going on, not dissipating the energy, holding it there and leaving it for the performance, not leaving it behind in the dressing room. Not a lot of gabbling, not a lot of messing about, holding it. And that's really very important for me. I've always had to have an inner life. And that was very much Alec. He could not suffer anybody messing about in the wings, in his eye line. He couldn't suffer gabble among the audience. They had to be quietened and things taken away that were distracting him. And I learnt that from him. And I learnt things like not having a glass of wine, you know, before going on, being highly, highly professional. You've got to remember, this is my first West End play. I had done theatre before, but never in the West End. And if you're going to sustain a year's run, you've got to hold something back.
So that's
the chief thing that I learnt from him, is to have inner peace and stillness. Terribly important to me now.
And as Felicity Rumpers, you of course were temptation. You were the love interest, as it were. Going back to your initial interview with Ron Eyre, did you come across any instances where people tried to take advantage of you in auditional, as say with Harvey Weinstein today?
Well, what worried me a little bit in the habeas corpus era, shall we call it, was the day that all was quiet and I was taken onto the stage with Alec and Ron, and they had me stripped down to undies because, as you say, love interest, and he had to do a scene with me where supposedly I've come in for an examination to his surgery. And there's this lovely, lovely little scene, very moving, where he goes, "Hello, knee," and "Hello, toes," or whatever. But I didn't know what they were trying to do with me, and that did come as a worry. I'm putting this very, very badly. But Ron wanted me to be the opposite of a buxom wench. He wanted me to be almost a cardboard cutout. Little girls have books with dollies in, and they cut out the dolly and they cut out the clothes, and they then put the clothes with little tabs over the shoulders. They wanted me to be that image. So that it very interesting. I didn't know what they were doing, and I found it rather unnerving that they were both of them creeping around. What they were doing, bless them, without really explaining to me, was making sure that I didn't look sexual. Alan has written this play to be the very antithesis of sexual. It's all in his imagination. I'm a dream figure. I'm the Virgin Mary, an actual fact. The character is a Virgin Mary. She's untouchable. It's quite complex. I don't know what was in Alan's mind, but this is how I see it now. She's untouchable, and so when he's sort of going over me, it's really, I can't touch you. It's, you know, you are my imaginary female, you know, I'm married to this wardrobe, as he calls his wife. You know, you are my dream, my virgin, my whatever. I didn't realise what they were doing, though. And I did find it very uncomfortable to have these two men circling me and Ron pulling up the bra straps. And then he did something. He got the wardrobe mistress to do something with the bra. So it was all pointed and weird. So that I kind of looked almost like I was out some science fiction thing.
Hmm.
So far from being sexy, I looked untouchable in it.
But did you find it in
that? So I found all that a bit unnerving until with hindsight, I realised what they were trying to do and really what the character meant.
What I'm intrigued, though, is that one of the most beautiful women in the film industry at the time, did you find that people tried to take advantage of that?
Yes, there was the morning when I was filming The Vampire Lovers, the morning where Ingrid Pitt, the lesbian vampire in this Hammer film, is lying in the bath with nothing on, and the extremely, exceedingly unpleasant producer that had been brought in to heat up Hammer films, who were dying at the time, said to me, look, I want you to take your top off. It's only for the Japanese version, and don't worry, so nobody will see it except the Japs. And so if you take your top off for this scene, and that's fine, because she's coming as a cat to rape you. And so there we are. So, and it wasn't in the contract. Nothing was in the contract. I was very unnerved by it, but I made no fuss at all, and I did it. And sadly, that has come back continually to haunt me.
You're listening to the actress Madeline Smith on the Oldie Podcast, talking to me, Harry Bucknell, about working with one of the most celebrated actors of the last century, Sir Alec Guinness. If you enjoy the series and would like to advertise on the programmes, then please email publisher@theoldie.co.uk.
Going back to habeas corpus, Margaret Courtney was of course Dr. Wixty's wife, Maggie
Marvelous.
Courtney.
Marvelous.
Did you find that as the run sort of began to sort of bed in, as it were, that you became the sort of the family as a company? I know that you wrote about how Alec Guinness sort of used to speak to his stage wife as if she was his wife almost.
Well, when I came down 10 minutes after the play had started, but I would come down obviously before, and there were bentwood chairs in the wings, as there were indeed on the stage. It was a very bare stage, very interesting. Again, all of the imagination. A wonderful rainbow, white flats and white bentwood chairs, and that was your lot.
Three chairs on the stage.
And so at the back we had some others, some extras. So Alec, Maggie Courtney and I sat together, but I sat very quietly, and they gossiped. Maggie Courtney was huge fun. She was an old Shakespearean actress, not old at all, actually. She was 50. Crikey. To me, that was ancient.
Mm.
And a well-heeled lady. And a little bit overweight, you know. So she wore a corset. I used to see Maggie in a corset all the time. She'd waddle around in her corset. She was great. And Alec adored her. And she adored Alec. And she dreaded the moment that he would leave after a year. And she encouraged him to gossip. And actually, it was a very good thing, because it relaxed him very much, because he was quite an uptight kind of a character, really, Alec. But I must tell you, he had very kind moments, which he wasn't only a gossipy, naughty boy, but one night the safety curtain, started to come in when Andrew Sachs, who was later Manuel,
absolutely, from 40 Towers,
was doing his wonderful, wonderful scene with Phyllida Law, who is, of course, Emma Thompson's mum. They had a fantastic scene together where he came in as the bosom fitter. He brings these falses, and she is the flat-chested spinster in her little brown cardi, and he's doing this wonderful, almost dance around her. While he was doing that, the iron started to come in one night. Alec had observed it from the wings, and Wendy witnessed this. I must have been in my room or in the loo or something. I don't know where I was. But he said, upstage. Go upstage. And it saved Andy's life, because Andy went upstage and it saved his life. There would have been no Manuel and no Andy, because that thing was coming in fast.
Othello was quite a character.
He adored
was
him.
A highly capable actor before. He was. He got fame for Dance Army.
We worked in round about the time in 1971, round about the time Dad's Army started. I was unbelievably fortunate to get 5 episodes of Doctor at Large, written by Bill Oddie and Graham Garden. These young doctors, a Doctor in the House and Doctor at Large, on London Weekend Television, and they imported Dear Arthur to play a grumbly old GP in 5 episodes, and I was his daughter, and I had loads to do, and I revered him.
How did you find?
I actually worked with him many times, strangely enough, but that was the first.
Am I right in thinking he used to, when he was touring in Britain, he would sail his yacht round Britain, didn't he, if I'm right in thinking?
Do you know, I never saw that ship stroke boat. Yeah. I believe it was a phenomenal boat, and he was always itching to get back to it. Yes, he'd finish at lunchtime, so that's quite enough rehearsing. Madeline, he said, or Maddie, you must never, ever over-rehearse. And as a consequence, of course, Arthur had a sort of rough relationship with his lines. They were always fine on the night. He worked around his lines, shall we say.
But as Captain Manning, he very much believed he was the officer of the platoon. How was he as a GP in the doctor?
Absolutely wonderful. Mm. Totally believable, totally credible. I've appeared with him when he played a headmaster. I've appeared with him when he played a butler. We did a commercial in Ireland together. He was in a fairly dreadful film, which I loved doing, The Bawdy Adventures of Tom Jones. He was in that. Arthur and I, we kept... I was, to quote another actor, I was his luck penny. I used to turn up for Arthur. I literally adored him. We were really good mates.
Your first film was Escalation in 1968.
That's right. Well, that's one where I was spotted.
Was your first big film with Hammer?
Yes.
Was Taste the Blood of Dracula? How did you get involved in the Hammer movies?
Because I had an agent by then. I had done a good, highly enjoyable 18 months of modelling with Lucy Clayton, and the acting agent had rung me again and various other parts, and she sent me along to audition with a terrifying woman called Aida Young, a female producer, quite unusual in those days to come across a female producer, actually very pleasant. And so I was given a Weedensy part in Taste the Blood of Dracula opposite Ralph Bates, and riding on the back of Geoffrey Keane in a bordello. Only I didn't know it was a bordello, and I didn't know why I was riding on his back. And I learnt later from a wonderful actor who was also in the scene, John Carson, that Geoffrey never stopped complaining about how heavy I was. I only weighed about 6 stone.
But as a child, the Hammer movies used to scare me witless.
They were frightening.
But were they frightening to make?
No. No, of course not. But I used to be terrified by them. In fact, all horror. I was always very frightened by them.
I may be affected as a result of them, but making the films, they must have been very amusing, weren't they?
Very amusing, and particularly Our Paper Moon. Ingrid Pitt, as the lesbian vampire, has to gaze out of the window into the middle distance. She knows that the grave is calling. Time is up. The moon is up, and she shouldn't be up. So she's gazing out of the window. And of course, our lovely paper moon, our paper globe, kept wibbly wobbling in the breeze. And of course, we all had to stop breathing. So funny. I think it was on a little string, and I'll never forget how difficult it was to get our paper moon to stay still. And I'd so much rather have those effects than digital. I so much prefer it.
You had the privilege of, perhaps didn't know at the time, but you were in the last film that Eric Morecambe made, The Passionate Pilgrim, in 1984.
Such a good man. Oh, my goodness. He was a workaholic, that one.
He was very ill, wasn't he,
unlike,
at the time?
Unlike anybody. He was a real workaholic. He never stopped. He kept practising the jokes on the piano and with his glasses. He actually was unstoppable. And we all had to stay in a hotel in Tunbridge Wells. And he stayed up probably all night to talk to Tom Baker, who was ensorcelled by him. Tom Baker was literally, tell me more. And Eric carried on talking to him, telling stories, anecdotes, conversation, until when I'd gone to bed. He was an incredibly generous man, generous with himself, generous with me. It was raining in one of the scenes we were doing, and he was so sweet. And he made some remark about, you know, you've got to keep dry or... Lovely guy. I never met the other one. I never met Ernie.
At the time, he was very ill then, wasn't he?
But he didn't let it show, Harry. He did not let it show. Nobody under the sun would have known that he was ill. And it was a sweet little film. The commentary was Le Mesurier. The Knight Who Comes Wooing Me was Tom Baker, and the nasty man who kept me captured in this castle was Eric Morecambe. I'm the maiden in distress. Ridiculous little film, but great fun.
You very nobly then reassured your acting career to bring up your family.
Well, I actually toddled off and did a degree before that. I finished off my schooling, really. And in fact, I'd already toddled off when I did that film with Eric Morecambe. My husband died, which is why I had to take a very large sabbatical. Mm. Yeah.
And now, of course, you must enjoy coming back into the limelight a bit more, aren't you?
I love to impart a lot of the joy that I've had in this extraordinary and very fortunate career.
In the article, you write about habeas corpus, the masterstroke of the finale that Alan Bennett had written. Can you just remind us of that and why you think it was a masterstroke?
There's such wisdom in every single line. It is so wise beyond Alan's years. It is a poem about death, really, and about making the most of every moment. I finished the article with he who's lost lasts longest, and then the light goes out.
Madeline, I hope your lust is lasting longest. Thank you so much for being my guest on the podcast today. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Harry.
Well, that was a bit of fun, wasn't it?
Guinness Was Good For Me by my guest Madeline Smith can be read in the August edition of the Oldie magazine. My thanks to Wilton's Restaurant for their hospitality. If voices are your thing, then make a reservation at wilsons.co.uk. And if this programme has whet your appetite for yet more, then why not visit the blog for all manner of articles in every shape, form and size at theoldie.co.uk. Until the next outing, from me, Harry Bucknell, it's time to find a natty umbrella sticking out of a pina colada on a beach somewhere hot this side of Suez. And until Harry Mite releases me onto the digital airwaves once again, thank you for listening and farewell. With research by Joan Witts and David Anderson, and editing by Michael Stigliani, this has been a GameKeeper production for The Oldie.